but the business community has a very strong ethic that they are justified in only concerning themselves with their return, and their return, monetary return. And it seems to me now that the multinationals are like pirates on the high seas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And where will be the governing agency? The UN doesn't seem to be the instrument for that, for dealing with that piracy.
Well, you have more and more decisions which are taking a little bit everywhere, you know. I live in Costa Rica. Well, in Costa Rica, it is almost impossible to cut a tree without getting the authorization of the forestry thing.
Uh-huh.
Now, the businesses who are cutting the trees by the thousand, that is finished. Now, for example, the fluorocarbons that went into the air and depleted the ozone.
Yeah.
Well, they have been prohibited now in quite a number, in most of the countries on Earth. And you see, it is very serious. Let me tell you here something which very few people know. It is that I'm a member of a World Commission on the Oceans, which has been created recently. We're going to meet for the first time in Japan at the end of December, set up by the president of Portugal. What we forget is that if the little diatoms and the plankton and the little things, the algae which are swimming on the seas and the oceans, which cover two-thirds of the Earth, if they do not survive the ultraviolet rays that come through the ozone holes, we are going to lose two-thirds of the oxygen of this planet. That is what the scientists are looking after. So all these are things which you have to warn about. And the question, of course, sometimes is touch and go. Are the governments going to react? Is the business going to react? And it is a little bit a race with time. And you have many people who say we're going to lose because we're doing it too slowly. And you have others like myself who are optimistic, say, well, if we say that we're going to lose, then we're going to lose. At least let us declare that we can do it and that we should accelerate.
That's great. That's functional optimism.
I have become an optimist in my life.
Because
look, when the war was over in 1945, I joined the UN just by accident, writing an essay as a young man. And when I got to Lake Success in a war factory, I said, look, if France and Germany had three wars in my parents' time, and my grandparents had five successive nationalities without leaving the village, and we were white countries, highly civilized countries, if they had three wars, 1817, 1914, and now, how can I expect communists and capitalists, rich and poor, blacks and white, Chinese, they will never do it. Within 20 years, there's going to be somewhere an incident, and it's going to blow it up. And today, we have another world war. I was told in the UN when I joined there by a British delegate, young man, what do you come to do here? So I came to work for peace. Oh, yes? Well, I don't want to see it happen to my children, the Gestapo, where I was in prison, and all the horrors I saw during this war. And he said, well, I pity you because this organization is not going to last 5 years. It is celebrating the 50th anniversary today. Yeah. When I joined Lake Success, the biggest problem on the agenda of the UN was decolonization. And I was told that it would take 100 to 150 years to do it.
Really?
It was done in 40 years. It is incredible. I was told that apartheid would never cease. Apartheid has ceased.
Yeah, incredible.
So that today, in the UN, I declare without any hesitation, on the 50th anniversary, that from a very pessimistic young man, in 1945, I become a very optimistic old man. Mm. And that the most important thing is to believe in it. Because if you have no hope, well, then it doesn't work. So we must have a vision, and we have to work on it. And I really believe that the human species can do it.
I live in India a lot, and I live in the United States. And the United States, there are some very, as an affluent leader, there are some very disheartening things about inner cities, about the politicizing of government. Mm-hmm. About the disparity of the haves and the have-nots. the shift doesn't come, you give examples, but the shift of mass consciousness, mm-hmm. is it only coming through legislation or through, or does it come, because the awakening is very minimal still. In the affluent country isn't ready to climb off the top of the mountain, mm-hmm. and yet it is the problem, as we pointed out. And I would love to have your hopefulness. I mean, I sit, what Trungpa Rinpoche once said to me was, stay halfway between hope and hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a functional strategy. That you're very hopeful, or you're very optimistic, as you say. And I know it's good press to be optimistic, mm-hmm. but I see the decay of social institutions, mm-hmm. and I see a very dark period coming, because I see increasing destabilization of social systems, and I don't see that clearly, what you're talking about.
Well, I think that when I see a situation which is in a bad condition, I have to feel like a doctor. If you say, well, here is the sickness, I cannot do anything about it, it's finished.
Yeah.
But as a doctor or as a political man, you have to say there must be a way of solving it.
Yeah.
And when you begin to try, sometimes you fail, and you say, well, the patient died, and the doctor says, well, I did my best, maybe I have learned something for the next time. Hmm. And the next time he will succeed. So for social problems, we have to be a little bit like the healers. And I just give you an example. We had a meeting there on violence. And again, they said violence is increasing everywhere. Now, I'm proposing that we should really have an ideal of a totally non-violent society in the next millennium. And thinking about it, I discovered something very interesting. It is that the United Nations, as a result of its efforts, has come to the point that wars between nations have almost disappeared. Out of 79 conflicts today, you have only 3 conflicts which are international: Cyprus, Middle East, and Kashmir, and the UN had put a big band-aid on it. All the others are internal, like Yugoslavia, like Somalia, yeah. and so on, in which the UN has no experience and has now been asked to come in. But international conflicts have almost disappeared. When I talked to a head of state at a lunch or dinner, I said, do you think you could become famous by winning a war? They look at me as if I was an idiot. And I say, would you like to have the Nobel Prize for Peace? And they smile. In other words, the large majority of heads of states no longer want to be Napoleons or Alexanders the Great.
Yeah.
They want to get the Nobel Peace Prize, which is enormous. Then I came to another thing. Suddenly it occurred to me, I said, what were the greatest violence at the beginning of the century? And you know what it was? It was labor violence, which led to communism. It was the labor disputes, the poor workers who really revolted against the owners, and we had the birth of communism. Well, in 1919, before the League of Nations, there was an organization created, which was the International Labor Organization, with laborers, governments, and employees. And you know that from number one on the list of violence at the beginning of the century, labor violence is last on the list. Why? Because they sat together, they have hundreds of agreements, hundreds of ways of mediation, and today we have been able to solve practically labor violence, because the worst that is tolerated is a strike. Now, if we have done this for labor, we should be able, and if we have done it for conflicts between nations, my conclusion is, let us do it for other fields too.
But
so there's always hope which you can have.
Yeah.
Maybe it's an illusion, maybe
no.
I will be wrong, you see, but it is my duty always to be like a doctor on the hopeful side.
I would love to have you as my doctor. Where does, in your life, because you've written, I've read some beautiful things you've written. I mean, true poetry. You're a poet. You're a real poet. And I would like to just hear how you replenish, or let me ask it another way. In this whole formula we're talking about optimism,
mm-hmm.
there is some a deeper rhythm that you are playing with all the time in your life that is infusing you with energy. And I'd like to hear your interplay with that a little bit, if you can talk about that.
Well, I would say that basically, when I remember my very early youth, is that I've always considered that life was a miracle. We spoke German there, so I said that life is göttlich, divine, because it was the biggest adjective I could have around. I went to the church in the morning, heard the old organ player, and I was in heaven by just listening to this, because life was beautiful. But I was living on a border, and on the other side of the border, the people were enemies. And as a kid, I said, how can they be enemies? Why do we kill each other? The birds are flying over the borders. The sun is going over it. The moon. What is this nonsense? And then later on, we had war. I was a refugee. I was arrested by the Gestapo and things of this sort. And I must say that progressively, I lost completely faith in this notion that life was a miracle. And there was one event during the war which changed my course to at least adapt my human being to having always a positive attitude. It was a story, I've written it in one of my books, it's called Thank You, Dr. Kue, which was, I was at the University of Heidelberg, and I had a student from Yugoslavia next to me who one day told me that he was very sick, had tuberculosis, and that I should go to the library to find a book written by a certain Dr. Kue. So before giving him the book, I read it, and I read a most incredible story, because Kue, together with Sigmund Freud, was a student of a French professor called Charcot, who had shown that if you hypnotize a person, that person can do things which they cannot do when they are awake. So what he discovered was the subconscious and the conscious. And Freud then became very famous by studying the sicknesses of the subconscious and was at the origin of the whole movement of psychiatry. Kue became a healer. He based it on the fact that your subconscious is more important than the conscious as the hypnotizing proof. So he said, you can use your subconscious to make your life better if you use two moments of your day which are very precious. When you wake up and when you come asleep. When you wake up, the subconscious is still alive, so trigger your subconscious to have the conscious operate during the day. And this is where he said, every morning when you wake up, you just say, I feel wonderful, I feel better than yesterday, I've never felt so good in my life, in order to trigger the whole day, and do the same when you go to bed, and do it to your child. Okay, that is what I learned. Well, the young man was healed of tuberculosis, and everybody was surprised. Then during the war in France, one day, I had a French underground name called Louis Parisot, and I was in a building in a French administration where someone, my secretary, told me, Mr. Parisot, there are some gentlemen who want to see you. And I said, well, gentlemen who want to see me, oh yes, on behalf of Mr. Royer, a friend of yours. And I just learned that Royer had been arrested. So I said, look, I'm going to disappear to the attics and you let me know what's happening. So, and you send me so-and-so. So I was in the attics and then the guy came and said, look, the Germans are in the house. They have a prison wagon in front of the house. They know that you are here. They are asking everybody to look on. They're asking everybody to come out of the office. They're going to arrest you. So here I was in the attic. My God. I was already arrested by the Gestapo a second time. That would be the end. So the way which people did at a time, sometimes they climbed on the roof, but then the Germans just shot you like a duck. So I remembered Kue. And I said, well, let me put you in the Kue position. this is fantastic. Can you imagine I'm 19 years old and they're after me? So let me put myself in a beautiful, happy condition. This is incredible. And I smoked a cigarette and I said to myself, okay, let me put myself into a very positive attitude. And once this was done, I said, okay, now, how could I get out of this situation? And I said, with the French, I wouldn't have a chance because they're very smart. But the Germans are a little dumb. Now, what could I do which the Germans would never expect me to do? And it came right away. Just walk down to them. So I changed my hair, smoked a cigarette, put a file under my arm, and I walked all the staircases. I didn't see much without my glasses, and on the second floor, I saw some bald heads, and I said, that must be the Germans. So I walked to them, and my secretary was there, and I said, qu'est-ce qui se passe dans cette maison? What's going on in this house? And she said, they're looking for Louis Parizeau. And I said, Parizeau? I just saw him on the fourth floor 5 minutes ago. And the whole Germans went to the fourth floor after Mr. Parizeau, and I walked through the cellars out of the building. And you know that in 1989, when I got the Peace Education Prize of UNESCO in Paris, they had the kindness of inviting my secretary, who saved my life by this statement at the time. So that since that time, you can never convince me to be pessimistic.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. It's a great story.
You see, and I'll tell you another story, which I just told to my bride-to-be, who's a wonderful person. It just came back to me the other day. I said, you know, we should write. I should write more anecdotes of my life. I remember one day at the UN, I got a telephone call from a young man who said, Mr. Miller, I have to thank you because thanks to you I got a job. I said, who are you? I don't know you. He said, you don't know me, but I got a job thanks to you. And he said to me, you know, I'm a licked young guy. I've asked for jobs and everywhere I'm turned down. But the other day I took a subway to Long Island because I saw the announcement of a job with the city government of Long Island. And I went there, and in the subway, I read your book, Most of All, They Taught Me Happiness, and the story how you escaped from the Gestapo and Dr. Kui. And I said to myself, let me follow Mr. Müller's advice. Let me be sure that I'm going to get this job. So I began to smile. I was absolutely sure. I repeated to myself, I'm going to get the job, I'm going to get the job, I'm going to get the job. I arrived in Long Island. A lady received me there, asked me to sit down to wait, and I had a very positive, smiling attitude. The lady had so many telephone calls and so many guys that after about an hour, since I was still sitting, says, look, young man, do you want to have this job? Yes, I'm enthusiastic. Okay, come, you're hired to start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. She did not even interview me. And he called me to say, thanks to you, Mr. Miller, I got a job. So I think that it is something which is very, very important to have an optimistic, hopeful attitude. Mm. You know, people don't like pessimists, really.
Yeah, I know. I know.
And you can inspire people to be hopeful, you know. I think it's a very important ingredient of life.
Well, your combination of that kind of hopefulness and the tremendous wisdom you've amassed from your sensitivity to the social and political climate of the world, that combination is a very profound combination for the world at this moment. Because we lose our way in our reactivity.
Yeah.
And your ability to stand back. See, the Kuwait example was standing back from the situation.
Yes.
And there's a way in which you have trained yourself, and it's built in a way, to stand back. It's a reflective mode. And recently I was talking to some friends in the White House, and I said to them, is there anybody there that is reflective, that isn't reactive? And he thought for a moment, he says, no, I don't know of anybody. He said, it's like being in a foxhole, and everybody's waiting for the next shot. And in the old days, like presidents and kings had elders. They had wise counselors who were holding the vision or something. And that's, in a way, what you were doing in the United Nations for many years.
Yes.
Is holding that vision. And Are we training those leaders now?
Well, I think that at University for Peace in Costa Rica, I'm doing it.
Is that working, the University for Peace?
Well, we have very few students. The governments don't support it. But like everything that starts, it's difficult at the beginning. But yeah, in a few years, it will be a great thing. But that's the type of teaching I give to the young people at the University for Peace. But it is, you see, there is always, in the United Nations, when I get there on during my trips back, all the guards salute me. And I'll tell you another little anecdote, which is interesting, because I have become known in the United Nations as the man for whom nothing is impossible. So I remember one day Waldheim calls me up and he says, Robert, there are some Americans who chain themselves at the seats of the Security Council. And the UN guards tell me that the only solution to remove them is by force. Now, I don't like force in the United Nations. Do you think that you could convince them to go home? I said, sure. So I went down there, sat down with them. There were about 15, two professors and 15 students, and they chained themselves in the Security Council. So I told them about Alsace-Lorraine and all these things, you know, to put them a little bit in the situation of my own life. And then at one point I said, look, if I were you, I would not stay here, because after all, you're protesting against the Vietnam War. You are the wrong place. You should chain yourself at the U.S. mission on this other side of the street, because the U.S. has never allowed the United Nations to deal with Vietnam. So nobody can do anything. In the Security Council, we're against it. You should go and chain yourself at the U.S. mission, you see?
Yeah.
And then after talking nicely to them, I said, look, I hope that you will take the decision to leave. And then I went out and I talked to the guards. I said, for heaven's sake, don't look in, leave them completely alone. I'm going to have luncheon, and when I have finished my luncheon, they will have gone. So I went to have luncheon at the delegates' lounge, came back, and they had gone. And the guards said, how did you do it? I said, look, for heaven's sake. At one point, one of them had to go to the bathroom. So they had to enchain themselves, and then one said, look, this Mr. Mueller is absolutely right. We're at the wrong place. And they left.
That's great. That's a lovely story.
So that there is always at least something which you can find as a solution. If I would write the stories of my successes in the United Nations on the most extraordinary things in which I would involve, I would be astonished. But always by having the feeling, by never saying it is impossible.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
Because from the moment you say it's impossible, then it is impossible.
I understand. I understand. And I just want to say that because I've read some of your material, I really hope that you will get up at 3 every morning and instead of writing letters, you will start to write more and more, because your whole orientation is part of the healing medicine that the world needs in this moment. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.